That music can mean only one thing. The gurus of How To are here. Alvin and Lawrence Ubel, or Larry, you prefer Larry, right?
Larry, I prefer
Lawrence.
Okay, Al and Larry Ubel, if you must.
Yes, and they should know that we are father and son. I'm the father.
I was wondering about
that. And I'm the son.
They're also known as Accurate Building Inspectors of Brooklyn, New York. So many different names to contend with. Yeah. And when the Ubels visit us, by the way, Ubel spelled U-B-E-L-L.
Oh, I have a whole litany of the way they spell it. It's Y-U-B-E-L-L, U hyphen Bell.
Well, your brother was on television for so many years.
They never got it right.
You know what I also find odd is that the name Udell, which is spelled U-D-E-L-L, no one gets wrong. Ubel, you put a B in there, and no one can get it right.
So you're feeling persecuted.
Wow. Horribly so.
Yeah, I said, how do you spell it? It says Ubel, almost like dumbbell, but Ubel.
Oh, that helped.
Oh, boy. Okay, well, maybe I should mention the phone number. 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Or you can leave a comment, a question on our show page at WNYC.org. And when you visit us, before we get going with the calls and the questions, we usually have a quiz, and we usually have some topic that you've been thinking about as well.
We have a quiz? Do you know about that quiz?
But usually we have a topic.
Oh, a topic,
Do you have either of those things today?
We have a couple of topics, yes. You want to talk
what do you want to talk about? Well, it's getting cold.
That's exactly what I was going to drive to. It's getting cold, and as a result, they're going to have the steam system, and many buildings come up, and that steam system, in order to produce steam, the boiler has to be over 212 degrees to make boiling water in order to bring up the steam. But it also makes hot water, which is a coil inside the boiler and a lot of other configuration. And what's happening is this time of the year is when we start to get cases on scalding hot water trauma cases. It is horrible. It can be controlled. Landlords don't understand it. Their superintendents don't understand it. But I'll tell you something, that people are really get damaged and sometimes never survive from scalding hot water. Water delivered to the house for the shower should not be over 140 degrees. That is it. And yet we find water at 160, 180 degrees. At that temperature, a half a second, you get a second to third degree burn.
Now, you have a chance to turn up the cold
right.
water.
Half a second. That's all you need.
The other problem also tends to be when you're taking a shower and you have an old-style faucet, which is in your shower, which has two handles, as opposed to the single-lever mixing valve. If someone flushes the toilet, we all have had this experience, all of a sudden you get scalded.
Because the cold water is being used.
Is being sucked off. And also, it tends to be that the cold water tends to have higher pressure through a building anyway because it travels through less pipe. When you have to throw the hot water through this coil, through a domestic hot water system, it loses pressure because of all the piping it has to run through. So that tends to happen also. But one of the things that people can do to try to either protect themselves or either advise their building maintenance staff about what's going on is take a simple meat thermometer, put it into a glass at the kitchen sink and run the water, the hot water, and then read the temperature. Then you actually have a number you can say to somebody. And meat thermometers are pretty accurate, or any other cooking thermometer that you might have, because they all go up to 200 degrees. And that's one of the things. And then you call them up and say, you're delivering water at 165 degrees, which if you have elderly or small children, this could be a tragedy.
Well, with children, it's even more severe because their skin has not been like built up,
toughened up.
The epidermis is still a very soft tissue, and they can get a scalding degree burn in an instant, a split second. If you take a look at our website, we have a chart telling you the hot water scalding condition, and it is really scary to look at the chart.
And that website is?
The website is accuratebuilding.com.
But one of the things I wanted to talk about also on the heating front is that now, before it starts getting really cold, it's really good to start calling your service persons. You really should have called them last month. But this month, get them in there to, if it's a steam boiler, to drain it, to clean it, to adjust it. If it's a hot water boiler, to bleed out the radiators, make sure the gas or oil burners are working. If it's a forced air system, change the filter if you haven't been running it for air conditioning. And again, have the system maintained. People with forced air systems should also make sure that the ductwork has been cleaned. You should do that once every 4 to 5 years. And there are companies that do that, so you're not redistributing the dirt throughout the building. And for people with allergies and things like that, you should do that. I don't recommend putting heavier filters on forced air systems because you may end up burning out the motor on the fan because it's designed for a certain amount of resistance. And if you put in like a HEPA filter or something like that, you might burn it out, which a HEPA filter, people know, is what they use for asbestos removal and things like that.
Okay. Well, one other thing before we start taking calls. There's the quiz, and every visit you bring us a different quiz. Sometimes they get it right away. Our listeners get it right away. Sometimes
they don't get it.
They don't get it right away. What do you think about this one?
I think this one's going to be rough.
This is going to be a toughie.
Al?
Yes. Name the hand tool used by coopers to carve out a groove on the inside of a round wooden barrel that holds the end and head covers.
Okay.
In other words, that cover fits into a groove. And there's a special tool that makes that special groove inside the barrel on both ends.
Okay. Our number, 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. My guests are the gurus of how to, Al and Larry Ubell. And should we take a call or two?
Yes.
Why not?
Okay. Let's go to Milton from Queens. Hi, Milton. You're on the air.
Hi, Milty.
I have a problem that's kind of unique that I think of. It just started about 2 or 3 months ago. The toilet would suddenly start to gurgle, and every time if I ran the water in the sink or if I flushed the water, it would stop for the time that the water was running. Then it would start again, and it would go like that for about an hour or two, and then it would suddenly just unexpectedly started. It suddenly stops by itself, and it goes away and comes back about a month or two later.
All right, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
This only happens after you shut off the faucet or stop the flushing mechanism, right?
It happens suddenly. It's not like when I stop it and then it starts. It just suddenly starts to gurgle or make noise.
And it's coming out of the drain system? Does it seem like it's coming out of the drainage
system? It's coming out of the toilet.
Out of the toilet bowl. Right. Well, what could be going on in that toilet bowl or in the sink?
I don't see the toilet bowl, you know, gurgling. But it's coming in from like the tank.
Oh, like the tank. What's probably happening is that the venting system that's buried in the walls is either has a blockage on it or it's corroded and it has filled up with all kinds of garbage like arterial sclerosis and it can't breathe. And so you're getting what is known as a siphoning action, which is causing that gurgling sound like glup, 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 like that, right?
My wife is saying no.
Okay, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Do you have a toilet tank or a flush valve?
A toilet tank.
And do you have you ever taken the tank top off and listened for the sound coming from?
Yes.
And is it coming from there?
It's coming from there.
It is. Then you might have a bad flapper. The ball stop that stops the toilet. It might be leaking.
No, because I had the flapper changed. Mm. You know, I had that changed relatively recently.
But it also could be coming through that if the vent stack is blocked. But you say that it also happens when you run the sink or no?
It stops when I run the sink.
Oh.
It's making the noise, and then if I run the sink or flush, it'll stop for
then
that time.
You definitely have a blocked vent stack, and you need to get a plumber in there to unblock the vent.
Oh,
and
can I go on like this? You know, if it doesn't bother me because it's only on for an hour or two, and then it stops.
But it could cause a sewer gas backup, so you should definitely call your super, or if this is your own house, get a plumber in there to fix it.
And thank you so much for calling us, Milton. Now, we have two listeners who have similar problems, so we thought we would put them on together. Cynthia from Morristown, New Jersey, and Betty from Westchester. Let's begin with you, Cynthia.
What's your problem, Cynthia?
Hi.
Hi.
It's not, well, I guess it is a problem. We have an attic that has absolutely no insulation. Mm. And we're leaning towards, I know there are different choices, the cellulose, the spray foam, but we're leaning towards the fiberglass bats.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to know if that's a good choice, how to install it, and, you know, whether we need a vapor barrier or not. And I also have an issue with, we don't have soffit vents,
mm-hmm.
but the house was built in 1926, so where the roof meets the floor,
yeah.
there's a space. It's not a proper soffit vent, but there's a space and you can see daylight.
Okay. Now let's get Betty in here. Betty, you also have an insulation problem?
Yeah, very similar problem. I have a 1920s house. It's never insulated. And I'm just wondering, you know, outside of a sort of a major renovation, is there anything that I can do to insulate the house without having to go through sort of a major renovation?
Well, to answer the the first question about as far as the soffit vents, as long as you keep the insulation away from the soffits itself, because you're going to lay it along the floor, just don't let it go all the way to the edge so it blocks the soffits, because you need to have air running from the soffit all the way up to either the ridge vent or to the vents at the gabled ends of your roof, so you don't get ice damming occurring. So,
should we install those things they sell, those vents, those rafter vents or whatever?
You mean those styrofoam?
Yeah.
Yeah, those are great. Those work really well, and that prevents you from stuffing the insulation all the way in. As far as the choice of insulation, I do like the open foam polyurethane. The problem with it is you can't be in the house when they're doing it. So you got to be outside of the house and let for all that to outgas. And it takes about an hour or two or three or maybe more to outgas, but you can't be in the house when it's happening.
Now, are you recommending that for Betty as well?
Well, for Betty, Betty's question was, do you have access to your entire attic?
I do, yes.
Then someone can crawl around the entire attic, correct?
Right.
Then,
yes.
I do again like the open foam polyurethane, not the closed foam, but the open foam. But there's a chemical issue there. So with the fiberglass, we don't have as much an issue. And again, you can lay it out in bats or in rolls, and you want to get at least minimum 6 inches, but we like to optimally see at least 12 inches of insulation in the attic. As far as vapor barriers...
Well, is this going to be expensive for her?
What about the rest of the house?
What?
What about the rest of the house?
You mean like the walls?
Yes.
The interesting thing is that with walls, you lose about 40 to 50% of your heat through your roof. You only lose about 20 to 25% through your walls. The problem is to insulate your walls is going to cost you probably 10 times as much as trying to insulate your attic. So the payback is going to be very slow and a long time. Also, it's a lot of damage to do to try to insulate those walls. And if you blow the insulation into the walls, it all settles down to the bottom of the wall anyway.
Okay.
So the top of the walls are left exposed where all the heat is. So
focus on the roof.
So really, if you save your money on the roof. On the other hand, if you're ever residing your house, then you could put insulation underneath the new siding, and that would be actually appropriate. Or if you're doing a major renovation, you can insulate from the inside out. You know, and that works also very well.
Thank you both so much for calling us.
Mm-hmm.
Along these lines, Eli left a message on our show page mm-hmm. asking, I have an in-law suite attached to the back of my house with separate electric baseboard heat. My in-laws don't come all that often, so most of the time it's empty. What temperatures should I keep the room at to keep the water pipes in the bathroom from freezing? Is it practical to shut off the water and drain the pipes? The water runs through the ceiling and down to the shower, toilet, and sink.
Well, actually, any house has to be heated to a certain degree, because if you don't heat a room for a long period of time, you're going to start having mold growth inside that room, because you'll have condensation forming inside that area when the temperature changes and the relative humidity goes up. So at least the minimal heat, a little bit above the freezing temperature. 32 degrees is the freezing temperature, so you should keep it at about 45 or 50 degrees. And most thermostats in a particular room don't let you go down to below 40 degrees anyways.
Actually, 50 more.
Some of them are 50 degrees, but some of them are 40 degrees.
So keep it at the bottom.
They keep it at the lowest temperature, and that will give a sufficient amount of heat to prevent condensation and mold growth.
But I want to hop on that and say one thing. It also depends. Like, it was interesting, the guy let us know where his pipes were running, because if they are on an outside wall, that makes them way more vulnerable to frost. Even if you have the room at 50 degrees, that wall could actually get lower than that. The other thing I want to say, again, what my dad said, was about mold growth. The interesting thing is that with new construction, a lot of new construction is with new growth lumber, which is different than old growth lumber. Like my home, which was built in 1930s, is old growth lumber. These trees were around for possibly centuries before we cut them down. The new lumber is all from new trees, and the capillaries inside the trees are very wide, and they hold a lot of water. And when it freezes, it causes the water to freeze and to mold and to do a lot of interesting things that we don't want to happen. So it's more important to keep the building a little bit warm at 50, 55, 45, somewhere in that range.
Yeah, when a building is vacated for whatever reason for a long period of time, happens to summer homes sometimes, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden they come back and it says, what happened to my house? It's all full of mold. You get an unoccupied house or having an unheated area is the worst thing that could happen, particularly to a wood frame building.
Let's put if you don't use it, nature starts taking it back. Okay.
Now we are going to go to a break in a moment, but we have some people who've called in with possible answers to the question, which is, name the hand tool used by coopers to carve out a groove on the inside of round wooden barrels that hold the end or head covers. And Jim from Yorktown Heights, what do you think it is?
Hello.
I think it's a Cooper's adze.
No.
Okay.
Okay.
We another caller. This one is Sari or Shari,
yes.
From Manhattan.
And what do you think it is?
It's a Croze, C-R-O-Z-E.
I can't believe somebody would get that.
And I have to ask you.
Well, by the way, a number of people also got it wrong. That Shari is the only one who got it right.
And I have to ask the obligatory question.
Oh, no, actually, one other person got it right.
How did you know that?
Google.
Oh.
Sorry.
But how did you Google it? I mean,
she Googled Coopers, and then she saw Cooper's Tools, and then it probably come up. And then it asked her when she spelled it wrong, do you mean?
No, but she had it right, C-R-O-Z-E.
Okay, well, hang on, Shari, because you're going to be sent something by the bells, and one of my producers is going to take your address and all the other information.
Yeah.
And what is she getting?
It's called Save Energy, Save Money by George Merlis and Al Ubell.
And right now that's really important.
That's an important thing. It's an important book. And it's amazing, the things in that book. I wrote it many, many, many years ago, and those things are coming to fruition. It's amazing.
We are going to take a little break. We'll be back with the gurus of how to, Al and Larry Ubell, after this. We're back with the gurus of how to, Al and Larry Ubell, also known as Accurate Building Inspectors of Brooklyn, New York. And we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Anita from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
What's up, Anita?
Hi.
Yes. Thank you so much for taking my call.
But of course. We never pass up a caller named Anita from New Jersey.
Oh, thank you. My question, I'm trying to help a friend of mine who recently bought a generator, mm-hmm. and last year they had a number of power outages that lasted a week.
Yeah.
I don't have the particulars on it. It's not mine, but it's a small one around 3,500.
Right.
And they just wanted to run the sump pump and maybe some lights. They were going to keep it in a building that's about 100 feet from the house, mm-hmm. so they need 100 feet of extension cord.
Right.
And what I'd like to know is the type of extension cord.
Well, that depends. That type of extension cord has to do with the amount of amperage is loaded onto that generator, or the generator is able
to... Well, it's a 3,500-watt generator.
3,500.
So when you go to the hardware store, you find these different extension cords. They usually tell you how much electricity carry.
That's about 3,500. It's about 20 amps or 30 amps or thereabouts. So that they would need a wire that is at least a number, I would say a number six wire, in order to get it to the house.
And also, when it's a 3,500-watt generator, generally those tend to be 120, 240 volts. So you need a three-wire or four-wire extension cord. I also have to say that there is major drop-off of voltage when you run that kind of distance. So that's an important criteria.
You try to make it as short a distance as possible.
Right. The other thing I want to say is that it's really important that if they do this, that they have a switchover box or a switchover lever, which isolates those things, the sump pump, the lighting, the refrigerator, or whatever else they want, that's in a separate box that's isolated from the rest of the system, because in the event the electricity turns on while the generator is on, it will blow the generator up. Okay.
Sometimes generators have what they call a release switch, that if power comes in from the opposite end.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yes.
Okay. What I'm talking about, it has to have the switchover component, because if you don't, you will totally damage and destroy your generator.
Okay, you're warned, Anita.
The other thing is that if you're going to put this in a building someplace, make sure that building has a lot of ventilation, because the fumes from the burning of whatever fuel it is using, whether it be gasoline or gas or bottled gas, are there. There's a lot of carbon dioxide, a lot of
carbon monoxide
that has to be dissipated. Otherwise, you're going to have problems if somebody walks into that building.
Now, as long as we're talking about sump pumps, Lauren in New Jersey wrote in to ask, my husband and I just had a new sump pump and French drain put into our basement. Now we don't know what to do with the floors. Should we tile it, put hardwood in it, or maybe carpet tiles?
Okay. I'm a true believer in you do not put wood on a basement floor. I have to say that I've been talking about this for a few months. I'm redoing my kitchen, and we finally picked out the tile for the floor, and we picked out porcelain tile that looks like simulated wood. There's a lot of stuff out there. I did an inspection for a client of mine where they had a wood problem in a floor problem in a basement where the wood kept buckling. Well, my suggestion was you rip up the floor and put down some kind of tile. They put down in this porcelain. They haven't had a problem since. So if you have concrete, you want to put down something that works with the concrete, and wood tends to not work with concrete very well. The other thing is, if you're going to have a flood, it's going to end up in your basement. And wood and floods do not work well together. So I would recommend something in either stone, tile, whatever you want to put, some natural material, but don't put down wood.
Yeah.
And we have another sump pump question. Boy, a lot of sump pumps out there. Mm-hmm. Jenny asked, just bought a small house and found water pooling the basement. Thinking about a sump pump, but what kind of professional can we call to find the source of the water? An engineer? A geologist?
Well, the thing is, with water problems, the first thing is you need somebody, could be a good home inspector, could have that kind of knowledge, an engineer, a hydraulic engineer. But the idea is to figure out the source of the water, and maybe it is a possibility. It depends upon the terrain of where that building is. If your house is up on a summit, it'll be an easy problem. If it is down in a valley, it'll be a more difficult problem. But the idea is to figure out the source of the water and try to detour the water away from the building if it is possible. The last resort, really, is the installation of a sump pump and a French drain and all that other stuff. If you could, because that relies on mechanical devices. If you could work it out by gravity and that it works normally and naturally, that is the best way to go.
We go now to Matthew from Brighton Beach. Hi, Matthew. You're on the air.
What's up, Matthew?
Hey there. How's it going?
Good. What's up?
So, first of all, I'm so happy to hear fellow Brooklynites on the radio today.
Okay.
Second of all, I've been living in this building on Brighton Fifth Street, which Brighton Beach, it's one of the beach blocks.
Mm-hmm.
And I can already tell you that I can tell that my building is not so well insulated, and it's probably been some time since my landlords have done anything about it. But pretty much every winter, right around this time of year, my apartment becomes about 10 degrees colder on average than it is even outside. So sometimes it's so cold in our apartment. Even today we have space heaters on, like ceramic space heaters that are on at 72 degrees, and it's still, it's on like a system where it shuts off once it hits temperature.
You want to have it?
Yeah, let me ask a couple questions. Are the radiators warm?
Are the heaters what?
Are the radiators in the apartment warm?
No, they don't turn them on until the 15th of October.
Okay, so you're probably, are you on a corner? Or are you in the middle of the room?
We're in the middle of the block, and we're in the back of the building. And there is an air passage behind the building. There's like an alley between our buildings and what's behind us.
And
even when the radiators are on during, during the heavy winter, it's still pretty cold in our apartment. And the only thing that really does it is the space heater.
This is what you get for living near the ocean.
And do you
for real.
And do you face north, or do you face south, or east to west?
We would be facing our building faces east.
But I mean, your apartment. Do you face the elevated track, or you face the ocean, or you face the aquarium?
No, we face west.
You face west.
Well, the thing is that sometimes an apartment will be cooler than the outside temperature, and that is because there is some sort of vector taking place in the building. Air is flowing through some cavity or the wall or something like that, and that you are not aware of, and that wall acts almost like a refrigerator to your house. If you have a movement of air through a cavity, and even if the outside temperature is 70, the inside temperature could be 68, 67, because this movement of air is drawing off moisture. When you draw off moisture from a building, the moisture has to turn into a gas. It needs heat energy to do that, and it takes the heat energy away from your building. So these drafting conditions within a building have to be controlled in some way. And also, that's why if you put insulation in the cavity of the wall, you're actually stifling the vector of air through the cavities of the wall.
But let me ask another question. Is everyone else experiencing this, or just you?
Yeah, everybody else is experiencing, and everybody in my building is so poor that they all borrow my space heaters all day long when I'm out at work.
Okay. it's a landlord problem more than anything else, because if the temperature in the – what's the coldest the temperature gets in the apartment?
Last winter when it snowed, the few days that it actually did snow, I mean, it got down to about 58, 57 degrees inside.
It's cold.
That's cold.
That's really cold. And, I'm arthritic, and my husband is – a happy camper in general.
Yeah.
We've spoken to my landlord several times about it, and they're nice people, but they're very cheap. And I was wondering if you could suggest something that we could do in the interim, aside from obviously calling the city on them. If there's anything that we could do on our own.
There's nothing really you can do on your own, because you don't have the control of the heating equipment.
He should call HPD.
He should call HPD and let them know that there's a problem, that he's not supplying heat. It has to do with, and it really does have to do with exterior temperature. It doesn't have to do with dates or, everyone says it's October 15th, so they got to start giving heat now. If it was September and it's 30 degrees outside, they really do need to give
heat.
The law says they need to give heat.
The law has changed.
So it has changed.
If it's cold, you got to give heat.
So, thank you so much for calling us, Matthew. Rachel from Brooklyn.
But I do want to say, be careful with those space heaters.
Yeah, because they can cause fires.
They can. They really can.
Rachel, go ahead.
Rachel, what's up?
Oh, okay, yes. Hi, thank you for taking my call. I love my apartment for many reasons, but occasionally there
except
is
one,
smell.
Right?
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
Occasionally there's a smell of gas that comes perhaps when I'm using my oven, I'm not completely sure, afterwards, and it kind of drifts through part of the apartment. Mm-hmm. When I called the utility people to come and check to see if there was a gas, they were not able to find a gas leak. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, is there any other reason that there could be the smell of gas? Because I'm not the only one who smells it. The previous tenant commented about it occasionally as well.
Let me ask you a question.
And I've been in the apartment for a year, and thankfully nothing bad has happened.
How often do you – now you're talking about the oven, or are you talking about the range?
I haven't noticed a distinction.
Is it the cooktop part or is it the oven part?
Right. I have used the top part and I've used the oven, and I haven't noticed if the leak is more when I use the oven or more when I use the range.
And the other...
Maybe it's more when I use the oven, but I'm not sure.
And how often do you use the oven?
Once a week.
Well, there are a couple of possibilities. She can stop baking.
That's one thing, but I wouldn't want to ask her to do that. What I'd prefer is actually fix the problem. It could be, and does the smell dissipate the more you use the oven, or it stays pretty consistent?
I haven't been able to figure that out.
Because my first instinct is that because you don't use it very often, that there's dust burning off of and dirt burning off of your oven every time you use it, and then in the week to follow, the dirt reaccumulates. It's kind of like when the first startup of a forced air heating system, everyone smells this burning smell that starts, and basically that's just the dust burning off of the heat exchanger. So that could be what's going on in your case. They said that if there's no gas leak per se. Now, did they come and test it even with the oven operating?
No, the gas was disconnected, or perhaps it was connected, but the oven and the range were not operated while they were here.
Well, that's an important thing.
That's an important item.
Have to test it while things are functioning. To test something while something is not functioning is not a true test.
So I would recommend that I would call the gas company again. That's what we pay for, and ask them to come back and see if there's actually a gas leak when it's operational, and then let's communicate again in the future.
They do respond expeditiously because they are afraid of an explosion.
Yeah,
that's
bad for business.
They're bad for publicity.
National Grid is concerned.
They'll show up pretty quickly if you say I smell gas.
Now we don't have a lot of time, but Rudy in Queens has asked when the super turns off the hot water to repair a leak or something. There's a huge amount of rust. I hope it's only rust in the water. And we're advised that this is normal and we should run the water until it runs clear. Mm-hmm. Last time it took hours to clear up and clog the outlet, which had been running okay, causing a flood. How can this be normal? I live in a mid-rise, about 45 units.
Well, what happened is some of these older buildings have iron piping in them. And they also have some copper and probably some brass mixed in together. And there's a galvanic action that is taking place that is accelerating the corrosion of the iron piping. This iron oxide settles down at the bottoms of the pipes, and water only flows through the middle. When they shut the system down, now water is now rushing through the whole pipe and disturbs that iron oxide. And sometimes it could take many gallons of water to wash away all of that residue.
It seems like a terrible waste of water.
And wasting of water is better than eating and digesting the iron oxide.
And the other thing is that every time you open and close a valve, that releases a lot of dirt also. So that's one of the problems
that occurs
also.
Yes.
Now, you're going to be back on November 14th, but before then, Larry, you make an offer to our listeners that they can get in touch with you?
Yes, and I apologize. My email was down for a while, so I apologize for not responding to anybody, but my email is back up, and you can email me at larry@ubell.com or larry@accuratebuilding.com or just go to our website and give me your telephone number, please.
Because you can't just figure
sometimes
it out based
like
on
here, it
what
goes back and
somebody
forth.
Writes.
There's lots of questions.
Yes, telephone numbers are important.
Okay, well, then again, as I mentioned earlier, you will be back on November 14th. Don't rush it. We still have about 15 seconds.
What's
going to happen
then?
What
are we going to do then? I think we're going to show all of America how to go forth and fix.
And what's going to happen?
Money and
do it safely.
Okay. Well. Meanwhile, so what are you going to have for dinner tonight?
That much time?
I don't know. I don't have a kitchen anymore.
Well,